For today's podcast episode, we're going to talk about something extremely easy: how to solve the student loan crisis in America. So this is a really contentious topic. We're seeing lots of discussion on this, in the media, in the political race that's going on for president right now, but really not seeing as much as I would think. And furthermore, some of the proposals that are out there are things that most likely would not happen. They're sort of like opening shots across the bow about what people would like to happen. So I want to talk about a little bit about the survey that we did of our readers. Luckily, we've got a whole bunch of people that have a lot of debt that have a lot of opinions that I'm really grateful for, because we sent out this blast to our email list that hopefully you're on. Hopefully you're getting those updates, because I put a lot of time into them and try to show you what's going on in the student loan world and what you need to know about. I sent that email blast out to the list and y'all responded. Y'all responded in a big way. Over, I think, 1,200 people filled out that survey and gave us their thoughts about student loans and the election and what they were thinking about. So I wanted to share some of the data from that survey with you on today's show, because I think it shows the roadmap to what student loan reform and fixing the student loan crisis will look like long term. First off, we asked a question, kind of the million-dollar question: would you want the federal government to forgive all student loan debt? And, you know, I didn't ask necessarily and paid tons of money for it. I just said, do you want it all forgiven? And the clear majority of you said yes. About 2/3 of the people said that they want all of it wiped away. So, you know, a clear majority of our readers think that we should have student loans forgiven completely. And then I asked a qualifier. I said, would you want to have your student loans forgiven if it meant that you had to pay higher taxes for the rest of your life? So in other words, if you have to pay money for this forgiveness, like, are you wanting to do that? 60% of people said yes. So not as high as the folks who all want it forgiven, but still a clear majority of people are saying that they would want to pay higher taxes to have their student loans forgiven right now, even if it was for the rest of their life. Now, one of the thoughts that I had was, well, what do readers think about the future president being able to help borrowers? Do you think that, you know, the future president's going to actually help borrowers? Only 25% of people said yes. So people are fairly pessimistic about the prospects of student loan reform, which makes sense. We obviously have not seen any really big action on student loans since 2007 in terms of, you know, creating income-based repayment and public service loan forgiveness. It's really sort of been piecemeal since then. And part of that just represents the stark partisan divide that we have right now. It's a very difficult climate to get much of anything contentious done. And so I think that that's probably why people are pessimistic. Here's one thing that kind of surprised me. I asked how important student loans were to you as a voter. And this is kind of really filling me in on a lot of things that happen in the political race. Like, now I understand why the race is the way it is, because I've just watched the most recent Democratic presidential debate with my wife, and we were watching it, and they only talked about student loans once. And that was because Elizabeth Warren tried to interject it in a topic that wasn't specifically about student loans. So it's just so fascinating, as big and painful as the subject that this is, politicians don't really talk about it nearly as often as they talk about other things. This is why. So in that survey that we did, most of the folks in our survey owe six figures of student loan debt. So you'd think that this would be their number one issue, but the data doesn't support that. In fact, only 15% of our readers said that student loan debt was their most important issue as a voter. So that's really pretty small. 15%, that's really tiny. And that's of a group that student loan debt is the biggest thing they're thinking about financially, because they have the biggest debts of all. So if the very small number of people are very passionately focused on that student loan issue within the group of high debt student loan borrowers, as a percentage of the entire electorate that cares about student loan debt the most, it's going to be very, very small. So a clear majority of our folks said that student loans were their third or fourth most important issue, or even less. So that just means that people care about, they care about other things. They care about the economy, healthcare, gun control, just what's going on in America today. They just care about all those things way more, it seems like, than their student loans, which is really kind of interesting. In our survey too, you know, you might ask, well, what kind of population do a lot of these folks that have high student loan debt, what do they look like? Like, who is that typical person? So the typical person who owes a six-figure loan balance is more likely to be female than male. So about 2/3 of the folks that have large balances are female, representing women pursuing advanced degrees at a higher rate than men, I think. And then a majority are Democratic, which, you know, you could say that, I think, about just younger people in general. And then I asked a few more questions about who do you feel the best about for student loan reform prospects. Voters clearly liked Warren and Sanders the most when it came to student loan reform. There were some folks that said Trump because we did have some portion of the audience that was Republican and thinks that student loans need to be reined in, right? But it's kind of interesting to me that the vast majority chose the Warren or the Sanders plan for reforming student loans. It seems like people do not want timid changes. They want major change because of how just, you know, difficult this issue is. Even though people don't care to necessarily vote on it, I think that it's still very, very important to people because of the anxiety that it produces. It just seems like other issues cause more anxiety than student loans, which is really kind of surprising to me. We asked a couple more questions about, you know, who do you think are going to be best for your finances and worst for your finances? Sort of the biggest number of people who said positive and negative things, we got a lot of positive and negative responses about Trump and Sanders. A lot of people said that Trump was going to be best for their finances. A lot of people said that it was going to be worse for their finances. Same thing for Sanders. Elizabeth Warren had a lot of people that said that she was best for their finances, but not worst. So that was kind of interesting. Another thing that we asked in this survey was, what are the big changes that you want to see with student loans? The most common things people said was they wanted lower interest. So you wanted to lower the interest rate. You wanted to be able to deduct that interest. So you wanted to be able to write it off on your taxes. You wanted more forgiveness options. So I'm assuming this means, you know, just better repayment terms or something along those lines. Just maybe more programs available, something like that. And then the other big thing was elimination of the tax bomb. So really seems like people want just more generous forgiveness and they want the interest rate addressed. So if you actually looked at some of the lower hanging fruit, what would actually be cheaper is to lower the interest rate or allow the interest to be deducted on taxes. That would probably cost the government a lot less money than forgiving debt. So that would be certainly something that I would pay attention to in the future in terms of student loan reform. That could certainly be a popular thing for a politician to try to address, is the high 6-8% interest rate the government charges for student loans. Now, it's interesting when I talk to big groups, you know, you ask, what are you most frustrated about with your student loans? It's really common for a bunch of people to yell out interest, the interest rate. And that makes sense because a lot of times people get so frustrated because they're like, well, I paid in $50,000 to my $80,000 loan, and now it's like $150,000. How is that possible? A lot of people just don't really have a great understanding of financial math, which makes sense because I don't have a great understanding of cellular biology or English literature or, you know, other things. So it makes sense that the vast majority of people would not understand the detailed way that financial math works. So if you pay barely enough to cover your interest, or even barely enough to cover interest and slight bit of principal with like a 30-year plan, you will pay in a ton of money, but you will not have hardly any impact on your loans because of that accruing interest. So a lot of times people look at that and they think, well, that's my problem. The interest is my problem. So I'm here to tell you that's not the case mathematically. If you had the same amount of debt, but very low interest rate, you would still have a huge mountain to overcome. So for example, let's say you were looking at, you know, a dental school that charged $100,000 a year, which several of them do. So $100,000 a year times four is $400,000. And then factor in, you know, let's say $30,000 per year for living expenses, or just 25 to make the math easy. So 25 times four is $100,000. 400 plus 100 is $500,000. And then if you had no interest cost, that would be it, $500,000. If you had some level of interest costs, maybe it's like $550,000 all in. And then if you have the current interest costs, by the time you leave school, it's like $650,000 or something like that. So is $650,000 different from $500,000 or $550,000? Well, yeah, it's different. But the problem is not the interest. The problem is how much you borrowed. So that is why 0% furniture sales are bad deals, because basically you're just getting the price marked up a ton, and you're basically getting tricked into financing it at a 0% interest rate to make you think like you got a good deal. Same thing is true for cars. You get artificially low interest rate on a car, you can afford to mark the price up 20-30% and then just bake in that 0% interest rate as part of the loss, you know, that you're attributing to, you know, maybe you can lose money on the lending arm of the company, but you can make money on marking up the prices. So that's why a lot of auto lenders, you'll see that they actually own their own banks. So they'll have like financing arms that are owned directly by the corporation. That's because they can afford to lose money on that side of the business and then make it up with charging higher prices so that consumers don't understand that they're getting a not a good deal. So I just wanted to point that out. if your main worry about your student loans is the interest rate in terms of what you're going to borrow, that's just not the right way to look at it. You need to be thinking about how much are you going to borrow. That's going to have the biggest impact, and not necessarily what the interest cost is, although it does clearly impact things. It's just not as much as people think, I think. We asked people what their number one fear of this election was for their student loans, and their number one fear is that nothing will change. So that tells you how desperate people are for action. People want to see action on student loans, even if it's wrong. Another thing people were really afraid about is losing PSLF. That's a common thread that comes up all the time on social media, and people just saying that, oh, I think I need to abandon the program, etc. Now, the biggest finding to me, and the focus of today's episode that I wanted to kind of implant this idea in your mind, is I think that this future of student loan reform and what will eventually happen is probably making student loans very much like a tax that you can opt out of. So this is really the biggest gem out of our election survey that I found personally. We basically asked if you would pay taxes for the rest of your life, how much tax would you pay for the rest of your life to have no student loan debt right now? So in other words, this is kind of like a tax that, let's say that you had to pay it, what would you pay? So there's different answers depending on people's kind of political affiliations. But on average, people said that they would trade 13% of their income on top of what they're already being taxed at. They would trade 13% of their income in exchange for no student loan debt. And we can split this out by political affiliation. We had Republicans say that they would only be willing to give up 10% of their income to have no student loans right now. And then Democrats, on average, said 15%. Independents were right around 12%. So what does this mean? If you think about that, student loans as a tax kind of makes some sense, because one of the big problems with the student loan system is access. So people who do not have wealth historically for reasons of societal neglect and societal problems, right? So think about folks out there that are from disadvantaged backgrounds. You know, student loans as a tax make sure that people can get access to higher education and make more money in the first place. Back in the day when you had a private loan system, you had to be subject to underwriting, which meant that if your family didn't have any wealth or any good credit score because their parents hadn't had any wealth, then that would hurt your chances at qualifying for a private loan. And so you would either get pushed into a loan shark type of environment, or maybe you wouldn't even be able to access education in the first place. So that's one of the reasons why the government got involved in student loans, I think, past the time when they got involved because of the Soviets, because of them beating us to Sputnik. I think that that's why the government kept getting involved in student loans, is because they kind of viewed it kind of like a little bit like a civil rights issue. And it really probably is, because if you look at the legacy of slavery, that's left a huge lack of assets for African-American families to inherit over time, which can be used for things like paying for education. And white families like my own didn't have that injustice and didn't have to deal with that. So that's something that's certainly very relevant. And if you look at, you know, other families from disadvantaged backgrounds, Hispanic American families in some cases don't have that legacy of wealth. And so you don't have those assets to draw on to get good terms to access education. So I do think that if you switched off federal involvement in student loans completely, I think you'd have a big issue of having access to education, particularly for people from disadvantaged backgrounds, and particularly for people who have lack of access to credit. That would be a big problem. So that would mean that perhaps only families from a certain socioeconomic background could send their children to medical school and dental school and law school, etc. Now, there would obviously be exceptions. Some schools would try to come up with scholarship funds. Some schools would try to discount costs or try to come up with some sort of way to try to make their schools more diverse, but it would not be nearly as easy as now. Now, part of the problem is I do think that the current loan system has given, in some cases, too much access. And what I mean by too much access is I think we've got a lot of schools that have popped up that are literally predatory factories, right? So there are certain schools in every profession almost. If you look at the ones that have the lowest average scores, they basically go after students from backgrounds that they might not be able to have the statistics to succeed in those schools or get jobs, but they'll go after them and they'll make pitches about the American dream, and they'll try to, you know, go after families that are second generation, you know, and try to get people to mortgage their homes. I mean, it's just really quite unfortunate. So it's just like you have to balance this access and preventing schools from trying to be predatory and trying to oversell what they're offering. Particularly, like, I think of like pharmacy schools, chiropractic schools. A lot of these places are kind of overpromising students what the job market's going to look like, and it's going to end badly for a lot of people. Let's talk more about this student loans as a tax idea. If you think about the Biden plan was that was recently introduced in the Democratic primary would have people only paying 5% of their income towards their student loans, 5% of their discretionary income. So what that's telling you is, based on our survey, that a lot of these Republican respondents in our survey, if you had a 15% tax that you could sign up for to get student loan forgiveness, a whole bunch of, you know, of our Republican respondents would actually not sign up for that. They would still want to pay back their student loans. And a lot of Democrats would not want to sign up for that. You know, a lot of Democrats would not want to sign up for it because, you know, if you're making a high enough income, it doesn't make sense to do that. It doesn't make sense to sign up for a tax when you could pay it back and it would be cheaper. But if you set that percentage of your income that you have to pay on your student loans at 5%, then that's something that would attract a whole bunch of people, including higher income folks, that would not pay back their debt because it wouldn't be advantageous to do that anymore. So a 5% tax is really nothing. So that would result, if you did had no tax bomb, that would result in the vast majority of student loan debt in America that's issued being forgiven. So if you want to think about the cost of that, you know, imagine the $1.6, $1.7 trillion balance, probably I would say 70 to 80% of it would be projected to be forgiven if you adopted the Biden plan, because of how many people that would attract to paying only 5% of their income on their loans as if it were a tax, right? So let's talk about the ICR plan. The ICR plan is 20% of your income. So the ICR plan has been around for a long time, since the 90s, yet very, very few people actually tried to sign up for that. And why is that? 20% is a little bit too high for people to view that as attractive to actually make payments and actually have that be a good option instead of just paying the loans back directly. So in other words, a 20% tax is so high that the majority of Democrats and Republicans would actually opt for the full payoff strategy instead of paying 20%, because that's so onerous, right? So that's really fascinating. So if you set that tax too high, nobody's going to want to do it, and everybody's going to want to do the full payoff version, and people are going to feel the pain of their student loans more because they'll actually have to pay it all off. So this is a controversial point because, you know, again, the majority of the people in the survey were not fond of President Trump, which makes sense. Basically, if you think about the Trump plan for student loans, he proposed 12.5% of income for 30 years with probably no tax bomb. So what's so interesting to me is that's very similar to what the average respondent in our survey said that they wanted to opt into. Basically, they said 13% of their income they would trade for no student loans now. That's almost identical to what the Trump plan is, especially for graduate students. 30 years, 12.5% of your income, probably with no tax bomb. And that's basically giving you the option of opting into that or opting out of it by refinancing and paying it back directly. What you would see happen is a lot of people that currently are open to using student loans, basically student loan forgiveness as their approach, you know, they would actually probably switch to paying their loans off with a 12.5% rate, and some people want it. It just kind of depends on what your attitude is, if you'd rather bet on yourself making a whole lot of money and paying it back directly versus treating your loans like a tax. That's a really interesting thought in terms of the future for student loan forgiveness, student loans as a tax. I think that's where we're going to be moving towards. I think that that's what borrowers want. I think that that's what borrowers are going to have to get, because if you look at tax bomb forgiveness, it's just not sustainable. It's just not going to work because, as policy, people are going to be so shell-shocked over writing this check that it's going to freak so many people out. They're going to put all kinds of pressure on Congress, and their Congress is probably going to flinch and remove that requirement. We did a survey earlier than this one that we asked like what people's typical savings rate was, and a very slim minority of people save more than 20% of their income, and maybe like 10-20% or something like that. Save more than 20% of their income. That means that people would be losing years of their retirement if they had to pay their tax bomb because of their loans. And that's not something that people are going to want to stomach. So just to give you an idea into this, one reason why I think this about the tax bomb is overlaying common sense on like predicting the future politically. And you only have to look at folks like maybe my parents to try to understand this, right? My parents, or maybe think about your parents. Well, what do they talk about whenever you talk about Social Security and Medicare? I find this is true regardless of what someone's political party is, about how they respond if they're old. You ask them about reducing their Social Security or Medicare, or cutting it back, or you know, eliminating or something like that, and people say, you know, they get really mad because they're like, well, I paid into that. You know, that's mine. I bought that. You know, I paid for that over years, and it's mine. You can't take it away. That's like stealing. You know, that's what people will say. If certainly my parents feel that way, that, you know, they earned their Social Security and Medicare, and nobody should touch it. But the problem with that is that the amount paid into these programs is nowhere near the benefits that we're paying out. So in other words, if you were to look at this as like an actuary, you know, which is somebody that looks at like, you know, annuity payments for in exchange for like a lump sum, or, you know, the basically tries to figure out the math for insurance companies so that they can break even and make a profit. You know, actuaries would be horrified by the Medicare and Social Security programs because the amount that's been put in is just so much less than the amount that we've promised to pay out. So that's one reason why people talk about, you know, enormous unfunded liabilities for these programs, because we are not taxing ourselves enough to pay for them, and we're paying too much money to afford to pay what we're doing. So that's kind of interesting, because that's why it's so hard to change these programs, is because people have this mentality that like, well, I paid into that, it's mine. And you can certainly say that like my, you know, people work hard, and maybe these social programs shouldn't necessarily be something that people pay in an equal amount to what they get back. That's a different conversation. All I'm saying is that there are very strong emotional feelings about programs that people depend on for financial security. And certainly Social Security and Medicare are qualifying in this regard. Another area of things that people feel very, very critical to them to keep is, you know, health insurance. I mean, that's one of our most contentious debates in America right now. And it's just a super intense issue where people are very, very serious about not having their health insurance taken away for good reason. I think that's one of the reasons we're going to see the tax bomb end up not happening for student loans, is people are going to feel that, you know what, I have been burdened with this for 20 years or 25 years, and I've made my payments, and I've faithfully paid what they told me to pay. And now you're going to send me a tax bill for hundreds of thousands of dollars. And as many people know about that, there's a whole lot of people that don't know about it or choosing to not know about it, one of the two. And so when you get this shared emotion of, we've been victimized by these student loans for decades, can we at least let it finally be gone? I think a lot of politicians are going to want to say yes to that. So I think that you're going to see some sort of effort in the future to eliminate that tax bomb. And so remember that if we set that tax or a percent of your income that you're going to pay on your student loans at 10%, which is where it's at now, you're going to get a lot of people that have the means to pay back their student loans that are going to rather opt for a tax. You know, in other words, they're going to rather opt for paying 10% of their income instead of actually paying their debt off, which is going to transfer a lot of that forgiven student loan debt cost to, you know, society at large, right? If you set the percentage at 20%, most people are going to want to pay it off. The government probably could make a profit on student loans if they pushed everyone to pay it off, because the government's getting the 6 or 7% interest rate, and then they're just having people refinance the debt at lower interest rates. So, you know, the government's probably going to make a profit if you're charging 20% because of how many people that are going to want to pay it off. So probably the ideal rate to charge is something in between 10 and 20% if you're going to eliminate the tax bomb. So that's what people are already doing. They're putting money into their tax bomb accounts. So you're already paying more than 10% towards your loans. If you did set it at 12.5%, you know, I think that the 12.5% for 30 years kind of number is intense enough that a lot of people would want to pay back their loans, but it's small enough that a lot of people could handle it without having it just totally wreck their lives. So it is a really interesting question about what the future is going to look like. Let's talk a little bit real quick about the different proposals that have been put forward by politicians so you can kind of get a recap of that. So the first one that was put forward was the PROSPER Act. This was done when all the Republicans had control of Washington, you know, around the 2017 timeframe. And the PROSPER Act wanted to have people pay 15% of their income until they paid back all of the principal and interest for what the standard 10-year plan would be. So that's basically like 40% more than the amount borrowed. And they also wanted to cap the borrowing amount at like a couple hundred thousand or something like that. So if you look at the amount of time it would have taken somebody to pay back the full amount on their loans, first of all, it wouldn't have had a tax bomb. So it eliminated the tax bomb, the PROSPER Act would have. The other thing that it would have done is it would have created basically like a 60-year IBR plan for some people. So for example, chiropractors that graduate with like a 5-to-1 debt to income ratio, 15% of a 50K income is not going to pay back, you know, the full $200,000+ basically ever. So a lot of the chiropractors out there would have been stuck into this plan where they would have been paying this 15% of their income basically for the rest of their lives. So the Prosper Act really would have been, you know, a tax, and it would have been, you know, 15%. So that's somewhat onerous, or it's certainly a difficult pill to swallow for a lot of people. But the positives are that it would have at least given access to some folks to some graduate programs, and it would have pushed schools to limit the price that they can charge for tuition, because private lenders would probably not want to underwrite an additional cost over and above the cap. So I think that if the Prosper Act had passed, it would have resulted in dentists and physicians kind of higher earning people would have been forced to pay back almost everything they borrowed. And then I also think that some of the more marginal programs like pharmacy schools and, you know, some of the chiro schools, like the schools of naturopathic and acupuncture programs, I think a lot of those schools would have closed en masse, perhaps. I think that you would have just had a little bit harder time operating those schools under that regime. And, you know, the schools lobbied against it pretty hard because they knew what it would mean for them, and it got killed. And so then you had the House Democrats take over, and now you have the AIM Higher Act, which would have been a lot more generous for borrowers, 10% of your income for 20 years. So actually a lot of our clients that were on the IBR plan or on repay, you know, if that had passed, we might have wanted to switch them to the new AIM Higher IBR, whatever you would call that. And it would have expanded PSLF quite a bit too. It would have actually enabled, you know, physicians at private sector physician groups that work at hospitals probably would have gotten access to PSLF. So it would have been very, very generous, right? It's moving us in the direction of the government covering the cost of education in the entire country, but it's not really doing that, not in the same way that like a Bernie Sanders plan would, because you still would have a lot of high income people that are, you know, going to in-state universities, in-state graduate programs, that would still be pretty incentivized to pay back their debt. It would just be fewer people, you know. So imagine, you know, if you had the opportunity to pay 10% of just your income, not even including your spouse, for 20 years with no tax bomb, that looked really appealing to a lot of, you know, presumably higher income, even Republicans on our survey that we did. So I think that would have really increased the cost of loan forgiveness by, you know, probably a couple $100 billion. But, you know, it would have been a nice program in the sense that it would have enabled more people to access some of these more generous options. Another plan that was put forward is the What You Can Do for Your Country Act. So this one was a little bit different than the House Democrats. This is the basically the Senate Democrats plan. So the What You Can Do for Your Country Act, this is like about a year ago, Senator Gillibrand and Kaine proposed this. It would have created 5-year PSLF, and also you would have been able to count payments made on FFEL loans for loan forgiveness programs. So those are the old loans, you know, prior to 2010, the reason why the 99% rejection rate's happening. A lot of those people have ineligible loans. So that would have fixed that. So again, that would have made things a lot more generous. If you eliminate the tax bomb, then basically student loans are a tax. If there's no tax bomb, it's very easy to talk about student loans, because your student loans are literally a tax. And do you want them to be a tax or a debt? You know, when I explain student loans as a tax, when they, you know, you're going for like a 20-year pay-as-you-earn option, it's a little confusing to people, because I have to explain how the tax bomb is roughly correlating to like a percent of your paycheck going into mutual funds to cover that future tax bomb. So you kind of have to work backwards and figure out like what is the 10% pay-as-you-earn payment plus whatever percentage of your income you need to do to prepare for the tax bomb. Add those together, that's the tax. If you eliminate the tax bomb, then the payment on your IBR plan is the tax, and that's it. And so that'll be a lot easier for people to process and understand if they want to do that or not. Now, the Senate Republicans came out with a plan too. So basically, everybody's tipped their hands, right? There's no kind of mysteries as to what each big group wants. The Senate Republican plan, and this is, I have to caution, this was like the leader of the Education Committee's plans. This wasn't the Senate Republicans at large. And I certainly think some of the more conservative Senate Republicans would have had a big problem with this. But they wanted to pass a plan where it was going to be 10% of your income for 20 years and no tax bomb, and it would have come out of your paycheck instead of the way that it's done now. So if you look at that mechanically, that would create one of the largest loopholes in history. Basically, anybody who possibly could, we would want to set them up with an S corporation, which is basically, you know, a pass-through entity. And so for an S corporation, you get to set a reasonable salary for yourself, even if you're making more money in profits than what you're claiming as wages. And so what you can do is, let's say you're a dentist making $300,000, you could set up an S corporation and give yourself $120,000 income and then have payroll. And then out of that payroll plan, you would have had to deduct 10% for your student loans. And you would be deducting 10% of $120,000 instead of 10% of $300,000, which is the case under the current regime. It's based off of your AGI, not what's on your pay stub. And if you try to misrepresent that and send in your pay stubs, and you should be sending in your tax returns, you can get in trouble for that. But this would have actually made it the law of the land to allow that. And so, yeah, that would have helped for a lot of those borrowers that are in default. It would have brought a lot of people out of default because the employers would have been responsible for managing it instead of the employees. But man, oh man, that would have created a massive loophole that we would have loved to take advantage of for clients, because if you can pay 10% of just wage income on several hundred thousand dollars of debt for 20 years, and you're just, you know, optimizing what that S corporation wage is, that could actually be more generous than the Democrats' plan of 10% of your EGI for 20 years. So that Senate Republican plan, I think that it was not very well thought out in terms of what the actual cost would be, because it looked even more generous than the House Democrats' plan. And you would presume that the Senate Republicans are a little bit more moderate than the House Republicans, but more conservative than the House Democrats. So you would presume that they would, you know, have some plan that would be in between the Prosper Act and the Aim Higher Act, something like the 12.5% that Trump suggested. But it seems like, you know, seems like not. So it does seem like if you did have a Democratic president and the Republicans in the Senate are already talking about 10%, it seems like 10% would be the opening salvo. That would be the initial discussion. And I would predict that the more conservative think tanks in Washington would really speak up about this to their Senate Republican contacts and say, hey, this is a really expensive kind of Trojan horse to total loan forgiveness. They would warn them of that. You might see some infighting over that, but it just depends. Even with all that infighting, I think that you would probably end up with some sort of like 10% to 12.5% of your income cost for a new reform student loan plan with a Democratic presidency. And then with a Trump presidency, I would expect that you would continue to maybe see limited progress in student loan reform. Probably more of the status quo. So only the House Republican plan would have increased the amount borrowers would have had to pay, and the other ones would have reduced what borrowers would have to pay drastically, either in the form of reducing the tax bomb that you would have to pay, or in the form of just being able to write it off more, or putting it on your pay stub, or getting extra PSLF, like that Aim Higher, or not the Aim Higher Act, the What You Can Do for Your Country Act, the five-year PSLF. I mean, think about five-year PSLF. Basically, everybody in America that's a medical doctor would want to do a residency followed by a fellowship, because almost all of those happen at nonprofit hospitals. And then automatically, if you do that, half of your loans are forgiven, right? So suddenly, so much for becoming like a primary care doctor or becoming a generalist or, you know, an OBGYN with a four-year training schedule. That would be silly. You would want to go out and get as much training as possible so you can get really high income as a specialist. And then you'd want to get half of your loans forgiven. The thing that I think I see more than anything is there's all kinds of unintended consequences with almost every single plan that's been put forward. And really, the folks making these plans are, I don't think that they're actually realizing that. I think that they're trying to do something that they think is helpful, but they're not thinking about all of the pros and cons of what they're trying to do. And so we'll see what happens. I mean, like most of the student loan experts that we talk to seem to think the same thing as I do, which is probably no action on student loans until basically we have clarity as to who the next president is. So that's through November 2020. That means people entering school in the fall of 2020 would be entering under the same rules that exist today. So that means they'd probably be grandfathered in until the end of their student loan borrowing for that program. So for a med school person entering in 2020, you know, the end of 2024, you'd probably be fine in terms of PSLF and things like that. The people that would first need to worry would be the people in the fall of 2021. And the people taking out loans in that year could seriously have, you know, an issue or have different loan rules that could be in place. And the problem is we see that these changes often take like 12 months to 18 months to fix, to get in place. So you could really even see these new reform rules not getting into place until fall of 2022. It's very clear to me that the battle is going to be over how generous these plans will be for the future. I don't think we're headed towards mass forgiveness. I don't think that we're ever going to get, at least for the next 10, 20 years, I don't think we're going to get Sanders or Warren's plans enacted. I just do not think that people will support that enough to pay for it, because it is very expensive. And a lot of people kind of did pay for their kids' education. So I think that there would be some resentment politics that would probably be involved. I mean, just from a practical kind of standpoint, predicting what this thing could look like. And I think that, you know, there was that Republican education department person that came forward that's running for Senate in Georgia, I think, who proposed giving a tax credit to people, a one-time tax credit to cover the cost of all the people who paid back their loans already to try to increase support for that. But that is, again, very expensive. And if you look at student loans being apparently like the third or fourth level priority on people who have six figures of debt, in terms of what their most important issues are as voters, there's clearly bigger fish to fry. There's clearly bigger things people care about. And if you're going to tax the wealthy or raise taxes or have a wealth tax or whatever you're going to do, then I think that money is more likely to go to other things that people seem to care about more than student loans. So in future reform pushes, you know, it's just important to remember that something that pushes people to the private student loan market will have a negative impact on folks from disadvantaged backgrounds. That will be an issue because of how underwriting is done. You would have to come up with some sort of rules to make sure that different populations of folks were not negatively affected based off of the underwriting standards that most people would use. And another thing that you probably need to have happen is you probably need to have some sort of cap on borrowing. So if, for example, if you were forgave student loan debt en masse and did not change any of the rules, it's absolutely ridiculous to think that schools would not take that as a basically clear sign that they can charge absolutely anything for their tuition. And it just does not matter at all, unless that there was significant regulations or reforms or limits placed on what students could borrow in the future. You know, if you did mass forgiveness, kind of like Bernie Sanders' plan, you know, guarantee instead of 120 pharmacy schools, that would be 300 pharmacy schools, because it's all going to get forgiven anyway, right? Instead of job problems developing in only a couple fields, I think there'd be job problems absolutely everywhere, because the schools would try to fill every single seat they possibly could, because it would be in their economic interest to do so. So for bipartisan student loan reform to work, I think we have to keep in mind making sure that every person has access to a higher education and to a professional school education, but also not handing blank checks to schools so that they can continue to ravage people's finances by charging whatever they want, which they will absolutely do without any kind of underwriting standards or any kind of rules in terms of what people can borrow. So a couple last things for you. We have studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. So that's the line that you can leave a question at. So if you have any comments about the election survey, if you have your own feelings you want to share about what you think politicians should do in the upcoming election for student loan reform, we would love to hear that. I certainly don't have all the answers and would really love to hear feedback from you in our community just to see what you're thinking. And the other thing that I wanted to mention is coming up, we have the six-figure debt to six-figure net worth investing course. So this is coming out January the 6th, a Monday in 2020. This is going to be available for 1 week and 1 week only. This is the most popular thing that we sell. Last time we had over 450 people sign up for it. And it's really going to be something it's the most successful course that we've ever had. And we get a lot of people that want to sign up for it, but we only open it for enrollment twice a year, because we want to make sure that it's up to date, it's fresh, we have new modules coming, stuff that we didn't cover the first time. So stay tuned for that. That's a key thing that you could do to make sure that your net worth is going to be positive and your financial freedom is going to be secure, no matter what happens with student loans and no matter who wins elections. So stay tuned for that. And thank you so much for listening to the Student Loan Planner Show.